Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Well, part two of Ancient
yes.
Tombs is finally here, right, Johnny Boy?
We're finally doing it. This was such a big case that we had to break it into two parts, and we don't love doing two parts, honestly, because we want to get you guys...
close-ended episode.
Yeah, we want you guys to get your resolution just the same way that we would if we were listening, but there are just so many details that it just felt right to make it a two-parter. And honestly, Darren, we like to keep them guessing. We like to keep them, you know, on the hook. So to speak.
Absolutely. I mean, we do love a little tease every once in a while, but, you know,
yeah.
I have to, speaking of teases, I kind of have to get right into this with Megan because I've been sort of waiting all week to talk to her. Now, I know what you're thinking. Could I have texted Megan at any other point of when we were recording?
Yeah.
Absolutely. But that's not the point. Okay. I like people to know Megan needs to be held her feet to the fire only when we're recording. Now, Megan decided very lovingly to share this picture of her two-headed mouse,
stuffed mouse, mice.
I'm not really sure. If it's two heads, one body, does that make it a mouse or a mice? Unclear. Named it Jacob and Marty. Dressed them up in this sea-themed prom photo. Now, Megan, are they lovers or brothers? Because I'm confused. Jacob and Marty sound like very gay names to me. Please elaborate.
So these mice were a Christmas gift from two of my very closest friends, Jacob and Marty.
Well, and what is more Christmassy than dead mice, you know? It's
right?
Just, 'tis the season.
Absolutely. And are Jacob and Marty gay?
No, they're not gay. They're cousins, and they are attached at the fucking hip. So it
literally.
Was like hysterical to me that they gave me this too. And I was like, what the fuck else am I going to call these mice other than Jacob? That's perfect. That's perfect for the whole situation.
So yeah, they're cousins who happen to be attached at the hip, a head rather.
Right.
So okay, I don't necessarily know that Jacob and Marty, the mice, are familially related that way. You know, that's their business.
True.
That's true. Yeah, none of our business. You're right. I'm asking all these really personal questions, and it's really none of our business. Like, we let them
stay in
do
your
their
lane.
Thing.
Yeah.
I know. I was impressed with the costuming, though. I was impressed with the costuming
and the
theme and the whole banner. I was all about it. We might need to see your prom pic, Megan. It's very. It was everything I needed. So
I love that. Love that it's not even really prom season. But, like, you know, we're going full steam ahead with prom. Let's do it.
Stay tuned
to the end of the episode because we have some listener shout outs from people that had seen Megan's mice on Patreon,
yeah.
And it's worth the wait. So, Megan, thanks for joining us again this week.
Thanks for bringing me back.
Yeah, Megan will be joining from time to time. And maybe, you know, next time she'll have a two-headed, like, rattlesnake.
Dragon.
Yeah,
oh,
a dragon.
Yes.
Yeah.
We live in hope, you guys.
But we do have to get to part two. And just a reminder, you know, for all the patrons, if you want to get first access at some episodes, merch at Megan's two-headed rattlesnake, perhaps next week, please sign up at patreon.com/shakenanddisturbed or click the link in our show notes, of course. And before we kick off part two, wanted to get through what you guys are drinking today. John, kick us off.
Well, I'm having coffee with a little Bailey's again because I have a bottle of Bailey's here that I need to get rid of. Not really get rid of, but, you know, it's been sitting here for a bit. So, yeah, I'm excited because I feel very energized. I've been stuck on that brown sugar bourbon for so long, which is delicious, but it's nice to go back to my one true love.
By the way, someone tagged us on Instagram, me and you, because Jamie Foxx was doing an Instagram post for brown sugar bourbon.
I saw that. Amazing. I guess brown sugar bourbon is a flavor, you know, not necessarily a brand. The brand that I use is called Heritage Distilling Company, and it's very, very good. Just FYI, that company's great.
Megan, are you imbibing today?
I am, yeah. I went a little basic. I did vodka and seltzer with lime.
Mm.
You, true Darren.
That's Darren, passion. Yeah. That's a Darren that's drink.
That's a very Darren drink. I actually normally do my vodka soda, but today I was trying to think of some ingredients I had, and I'm throwing
Me
this
too.
One back to Andy. It's almost my 10-year anniversary with Andy, which I cannot believe.
Oh my God.
It's March 21st, aww. So I literally can't believe it. We'll have to talk about it next week, but
yeah.
I am going to have, in honor of him, his favorite drink, which is tequila. I'm having Don Julio tequila and a little Fresca.
Now, Darren, don't get too crazy with that tequila over there.
You know. Nuts, you mean?
Well, we just don't need
you. What do you mean, John? John, what do you mean?
Going crazy.
What do you mean? I explain it. Oh, a female going crazy?
I'm just looking. Oh, my God. I'm just looking out for you because I know your history with tequila. Let's put it that way.
You really are my brother here protecting me, which is good because I definitely need help with the tequila. But I will go slow and I will sip judiciously. But let's get into part two of H.H. Holmes here. Why don't you kick it off, John?
Yes, I will. And don't take too much of a big gulp as I kick off the show. There she goes.
Yep.
Well, let's pick right up where we left off from last week's story, because the third and fourth murders from Holmes were Julia L. Connor and her 6-year-old daughter, Pearl, which is heartbreaking.
Oh, God.
Julia and her husband, Ned, lived in the castle, which we mentioned from last week, with their daughter. Ned worked with Holmes at his pharmacy's jewelry counter, and the two devised a plan to swindle a company in Chicago, according to Mysterious Chicago Tours. Hopefully they're a legit source, Mysterious Chicago Tours. But nonetheless, Holmes developed an attraction for Ned's wife, Julia, and the two began having an affair, which is like, you know, that's not too cool. You're like, you're kind of like helping this guy out, and then you're like sleeping with his wife. That's not.
But it happens.
It does happen. Sure. Sure does.
Yeah.
My God, I feel like we've had so many affairs lately on Shaken Stir, but
well, I hate to say it, but they are quite popular.
They are
couples.
Quite a popular thing.
Quite a trend.
Well, Holmes wrote that Julia, quote, lived for her child, and her one fear was that she should lose her, end quote. Ned quit his job because of the affair, bailed on his wife and daughter, and soon after, Julia became pregnant with Holmes. So basically, like, you know, this whole new life is sort of unfolding
now. They're
like
wife swapping.
Yeah, totally. Insisting that Holmes marry her without knowing he was already married, he agreed, but under the condition that Julia allow him to perform an abortion. Not like Julia is going to the doctor to get an abortion. He wanted to perform it. And
yeah, I'm not sure as a woman how I feel about that. Megan, maybe you're married, Megan, so maybe you have a little bit more
that's true.
Perspective on this, but granted this was a different time. So I imagine that abortions were even more taboo maybe than they are potentially today, but this seems like a major red flag. What do you think, Megan?
Yeah, I mean, unless there was no other way to have one done, right? Even if he was a doctor, I would so not be cool with Aaron doing that.
Right.
Yeah,
no.
Unless it was like that or nothing. I die.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe if it was life or death, but this does seem like a lot of medical malpractice. Like, you're not supposed to work on your family members.
No.
I don't think. Yeah, so this just seems like a disaster waiting to happen.
Well, that's a perfect way to put it, because he ended up murdering her during the operation. He wrote that another man and woman whom he did not identify were part of a criminal plot involving Julia's murder. They all seemed to be after a property she owned, but they were unable to collect. Holmes explained that the couple wanted to send Julia's daughter Pearl to live with their elderly parents instead of killing her, but he overruled the idea, worrying she might incriminate him someday, so he poisoned her. Oh, this is so disturbing. Julia,
it's really bad, but at the same time, like, I mean, I don't, okay, like, this is me trying to have some sort of, like, rational explanation, given the fact that we know that he was, like, at least considered maybe wanting to save her life. Does that show some sort of human quality in him at all? I mean, granted, he killed her, but like, is there something in his system now that's at least a trigger to know that it's wrong? Because that at least says that he's not blindly murdering these people, that he has complete intent and that he knows what he's doing. He's not just having these like blackouts of craziness or something.
Yeah, I mean, this definitely touches on something like the spectrum of murder and the intent of murder, because, you know, we hear about these crimes of passion where, you know, people get somewhat let go, you know, a little bit easier. They get off a little easier because it was a, you know, crime of passion and not some planned vindictive thing. I mean, yeah, either way, it's a murder, is a murder, and it's a particular.
Horrible. Yeah. Yeah, I'm just wondering if it's a character trait in him that maybe we're seeing. Like, this is sort of the first time where he's like, kind of, he's stopping to read his tweet that's about to annihilate someone, as opposed to just blindly sending the tweet.
Rage texting, yeah. That's
exactly.
Tweeting, yeah. Well, exactly. Julia and Pearl disappeared on Christmas Eve in 1891, which sounds so long ago, but kind of wasn't, really. Holmes also confessed to locking a maid in his vault to suffocate her, and when he was preparing to ship her body, was interrupted by another female tenant who worked for him as a stenographer and her niece. He says he also locked them in the vault. In May of 1892, he got a replacement stenographer, Emmeline Sigrand, I think I'm saying that right, with whom he became romantically involved. So there's a little bit of a pattern going on here. These women come into his life, he becomes somewhat romantically involved with them. But she became engaged to another man. Holmes wrote, quote, "This attachment was particularly obnoxious to me, both because Miss Sigrand had become almost indispensable in my office work and because she had become my mistress as well as stenographer." End quote.
Well, that does get tough. That does get
That's
a little
a tough,
messy, you know?
Tough it, thing to tough. Juggle, yeah. Well,
correct, yes.
Holmes said he tried but failed to take his fiancée's life and then decided instead to kill Emma, as she was called. On her wedding day, Emma came, I'm assuming this is Emmeline, by the way. On her wedding day, Emma came to his office to say goodbye to Holmes, and he trapped her in his vault. What? Holmes forced her to write a letter saying she thought it would be impossible to live a happy life with the man she was to marry and that she was moving out west. Holmes explained, quote, "She was very willing to do this and prepared to leave the vault upon completing the letter, only to learn that the door would never be again opened until she had ceased to suffer the tortures of a slow and lingering death." And
I love that he's just like writing this, like he's almost writing it as if he's the narrator of this story.
Ooh,
like,
that's a good
way
point,
that,
Aaron.
You know, like she was really willing to do this until she realized that she was never going to see the light of day. Like he seems so, mm-hmm. You know, kind of going, maybe even going back on my last statement of maybe seeing some sign of humanity and him acknowledging that maybe killing at least a little girl was one step over the line. This is like completely callous. Like there's no anything there for me.
Even the way he says Miss Sigrand, you know, it's almost like he's writing a New York Times article. It kind of goes back to what I was saying on last week's episode, part one of this story, where I feel like he was likely very influenced by poets and prose writers that were making big, you know, big kind of cultural art pieces at the time in New England where he was. Although
and
this
I
is,
think
I think,
also,
in Chicago.
And I think also to your point, he's clearly a very smart person. You know, he's an educated man. But also, people talked differently in the 1800s than they do now. You know, like slang was different.
Yeah, that's true.
you know, just in general. And I think we see that just through letters throughout time about people's language changing. And so this was definitely part of that. You know, it was it was 130 years ago, 140 years ago. So it is a little bit of a different thing there.
So you're saying that he wouldn't know what a selfie is what you're saying?
I don't know. Based on or like what WAP meant or something like that. Yeah, I'm not sure he knows what that means. I'd be curious to see if he knows what WAP means. Yeah.
Listen, he sounds like he's a smart guy. Well, anyway, Emma's dad traded letters with Holmes trying to find out what happened to her or if he knew about her location. Holmes was very cordial, writing things like, quote, please let me know within a few days if you did not hear from her and give me her uncle's address here in the city and I will see him personally and ask if she has been there. As I know she was in the habit of calling upon him quite often, yours truly, H.H. Holmes, end quote. So now we get a little more, Darren, you know, you were kind of like setting us up for what was his intent. Now he's very clearly withholding, you know, his intent and his murders from the family. So that tells a little story, you know, in and of itself. But Emma's family told a newspaper they believed Holmes had murdered her. So, you know, the family, I think, was on to his ways, especially if they had ever heard anything about, you know, his previous situation.
Yeah, I think that's right. And clearly Holmes is trying to divert attention away from him to potentially put it back on, you know, her uncle or something like that. But on May 1st, 1893, the World's Columbian Exhibition opened in Chicago. Spanning 600 acres, the World's Fair was a huge deal. I mean, even my dad talked about, you know, who was born in, you know, the mid 20th century, about the World's Fair and how cool it was. I mean, I would give anything to go to a World's Fair. It's obviously not happening anymore, but like the shit was very innovative. So spanning 600 acres, this World's Fair was a huge deal and attracted more than 20 million people from across the globe until it closed in October. According to Harper's, Holmes bought truckloads of furniture, crockery, mattresses, bed springs, hardware, and gas fixtures to prepare for an influx of guests from the World's Fair. Remember, he's running his murder castle here. He's got, you know, thousands of rooms and weird pathways. Of course, he never paid for the furniture, and the company that sold it to him sent out an agent to watch the building. When Holmes refused to pay the company, they sent out men in vans to repossess everything, but they couldn't find any of the furniture in the house, despite their agent insisting none of it had been removed. It's believed that Holmes was able to hide the furniture in the castle's hidden rooms that no one could find. You know, in my mind, this is like, you know, torture chamber central. He's putting all that all of his dark life in a place that no one can see.
Yeah.
America's first serial killer claims Holmes would take the Pitezel children to the exhibition, where he'd lure well-to-do women by offering them a room at the castle, which was nearby. Some of these women had traveled by themselves to see the fair, and their friends and relatives would have no way of tracking where they'd gone in Chicago.
There's no find my friends back then.
There's no find my friends. There's no social media. Even letters can take weeks to get somewhere. Right. And, you know, someone offering a handsome, smart, seemingly well-to-do guy, doctor, if you will, offering them a place to stay at this, what looked like to me a fairly luxurious hotel castle, probably seems like a deal too hard to pass up.
Yeah.
And newspapers reported that a large number of people disappeared after attending the World's Fair. The theory is that some of the rooms in the castle were airtight and soundproofed, and Holmes locked his victims inside of the rooms, gassed them, and then disposed of their bodies in his basement, which, as callous as that is, in some ways is kind of almost a perfect way to get away with it, because it's not messy, it's not bloody, there's no DNA if you're gassing them in these single rooms, you know, kind of Dexter style. It's almost this OCD way to kill someone in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, even just what you said about DNA, I mean, remember, this is late 1800s. DNA is likely not even a real thought, though. But, you know, so that almost adds to it, to your point, because it's like, you don't need to be super duper locked up and tidy about this stuff. So, you know, this seems to work for him.
I mean, if people can't even find furniture, they're not going to find a gas chamber, I imagine. But in 1893, Holmes hired an aspiring actress, Minnie R. Williams, as his new stenographer. And Minnie's parents, who were poor, died when she was young, and she was adopted by her uncle, who was a doctor. Now, he sent her to a conservatory of dramatic arts in Boston before dying himself, leaving her and her sister his property. Holmes said he had first met Minnie in New York in 1888. She sold her family. She told her family that she was interested in Holmes because he was handsome, wealthy, and highly intelligent. You know, a little bit of Ted Bundy-esque vibes.
I thought the same thing. Yeah,
just those people. Unfortunately, a good-looking man who's rich can almost get away with all too many things, yeah, I will
you're
say.
Right.
Well, Holmes says he found Minnie to be a bright, intelligent woman, an interesting conversationalist, and one who I could see had seen much of the world. He wrote, soon after entering my employ, I induced her to give me $2,500 in money to transfer to me by deed $50,000 worth of Southern real estate, and a little later live with me as my wife, all this being easily accomplished owing to her innocent and childlike nature, she hardly knowing right from wrong in such manners. You know, and certainly back then, women weren't encouraged to get their own schooling, to understand how money was made, understand how money was spent, this and that. So,
good point. Yeah.
You know, this kind of hero, and not for the lack of women, it just wasn't encouraged in society.
It was a different society, yeah.
Even today, sometimes that isn't encouraged, you know, in 2021. And so to have this this wealthy, handsome guy come to you and talk to you facts and figures with money, and you got an estate, and I want to take care of you and be my wife and this and that.
Right.
Again, it seems like an offer that it's hard to pass up.
I agree with you. Yeah, no, it's so important to think about the context of when this was happening, what, you know, what the resources were, what the cultural significances and expectations were, you know, and, you know, that which changed in our country in the United States decade to decade. So, you know, we're talking 130 some years ago. It's quite a different time.
Now, Megan, has Aaron been like, hey, give me your two-headed mouse and I'll trade you $50,000 for a deed? Has any of that happened in your marriage thus far?
Oh, yeah. He is constantly just offering me increments of $50,000. He'd be like, hey, can
it
you
is an
do
quality.
The dishes tonight? Yeah.
That's
yeah,
so Aaron. So Aaron. Oh, my God. That's so him.
Megan, we'll talk after the show. You seem to need help.
Blink twice, Megan.
Blink twice.
Holmes also got two additional checks from Minnie after they were married and learned that her sister Nanny in Texas was an heir to some property. So Holmes encouraged
bingo.
Minnie to have. So, of course, Holmes encouraged Minnie to have Nanny come and visit. Surprise, surprise. And he claimed he picked her up, brought her to the castle when Minnie wasn't there. I feel like I know where this is going. It was an easy matter to force her to assign to me all she possessed, and after that, she was immediately killed in order that no one in or about the castle should know of her having been there. So, fights her over, swiftly kills her after talking about money, and no one is the wiser.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect scenario.
It appears he suffocated her in his vault, noting that an astute detective found her footprint on the painted surface of the vault door made during her violent struggles before death.
That's so disturbing.
I mean, a footprint on a door, unless you're trying to break that door down or you tripped and fell, is usually not a common place to see a footprint.
No.
Well,
definitely not.
He later gave Minnie a letter saying that her sister had called off the trip, so it made it seem like, you know, she was never in the castle. You know, she just never even came. After defrauding Minnie of all of her money, Holmes poisoned her and buried her body.
Oh, so again, he's doing all these kind of like similar methods, you know, for a detective, even in the 1890s. Should be pretty straightforward, yes. The 1890s, I should say.
I was just going to say 1890s, yes.
Well, Holmes was getting too much heat in Chicago from his creditors, and they were preparing to arrest him. So he fled, and his business partner, Benjamin Pitezel, came with him. Holmes married yet again. I mean, how many is this?
Damn.
Four, five, six, something like that?
Jesus.
To Georgiana Yoke in 1894 in Denver. Holmes and Pitezel committed a series of scams together until Holmes murdered him and his entire family. So it's so interesting because we're setting up this image that he's, you know, here's this Holmes. He's got a business. He's well educated. He clearly has a thing for women. He's handsome. And he comes, you know, in my head, he's this normal, I mean, you know, murders notwithstanding, this otherwise normal, you know, you would never guess in a million years type of guy. But then he murders his business partner who's scamming with him and his entire family. I mean, that's another level of like serial killer, if you ask me.
He's a winner to me, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's right.
It's also kind of surprising that especially, you know, because he seems to go after a lot of women, but that his business partner, Ben, had, and I use business in air quotes, had kind of no idea. Like, these people kind of kept disappearing. He had all these wives. They clearly had a relationship, and it didn't bother him at all.
Yeah, or, like, I wonder if he was ever worried, you know, that this would happen.
Right.
As sad and tragic as it is. Well, it was the murder of Pitezel that led to Holmes getting caught. Pitezel's body was found in Philadelphia in September of 1894. It looked as if it looked as if he'd been a victim of an explosion. There was a letter in his pocket from his wife in St. Louis saying she'd join him soon. Then his body went unclaimed in the morgue for 10 days before it was buried, according to Harper's. Soon after, Holmes showed up to claim the insurance money on behalf of Pitezel's wife. You know, so this insurance stuff, you know, goes all the way back to the 1800s, folks, just so you know. Apparently, Pitezel and Holmes had planned to fake his death and substitute a body that they'd obtained from the morgue. I mean, geez, even in death, these scams are happening.
Yeah, but, seriously.
But Holmes double-crossed Pitezel by killing him and wanted to get all of the insurance money for himself. Holmes wrote that he wrote, quote, discouraging letters purporting to be from his wife, causing him to again resort to drink. Then the waiting from day to day until I should be sure of finding him in a drunken stupor at midday. Quote. By the way, good thing we have all these writing by Holmes.
Yes, but also what a long, like he's, and
long
I don't,
game.
And I mean this, and I mean this in the pejorative sense. He's smart and he's thinking long term. I'm, you know, discouraging letters from his wife going to cause this guy to drink. I'll be able to take, you know,
yeah,
take
no,
him out
right.
when he's drunk and kind of having this vulnerability. And granted, like, we're not talking about like rapid fire text. If he's getting letters from his wife, this was taking weeks, if not months, to kind of plan out. So it's kind of
Yeah, it almost makes the murders even that much more strategic and horrifying in a way. You know?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, worried that it might look like a struggle occurred, Holmes said that he bound his hands and feet after finding him insensibly drunk. He then saturated his clothing and face with benzene and ignited him with a match. Ugh, that's so horrifying. Holmes wrote, quote, the least I can do is spare my reader a recital of the victim's cries for mercy, his prayers, and finally his plea for a more speedy termination of sufferings, all of which upon me had no effect, end quote. And
so
that line,
so interesting that he's saying that, no?
Definitely. I mean, listen, that line is one of the most, really lives up to the show, you know, Shakespeare. I mean, has there ever been anything more horrifying? But yeah,
well,
very dismissive.
And normally, I feel like when killers are asked this question or murderers are asked this question, like they evade it or they feign type of empathy or something like that. He's like not even fazed by himself. Like he knows that he's a murderer and he knows that he's dangerous and he knows of all this stuff because he knows that the public, as he said, I want to spare my reader a recital of the victim's cries for mercy. He knows that this is not normal behavior.
He knows it's not normal, and all of which upon me had no effect, he says, makes me feel like it really is just another thing to do that day. You know, it was part of the plan. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, this is what he had to do. He doesn't care what's happening. He's executing on his plan, no pun intended, and on he goes with the insurance.
Well, here it gets even worse. Holmes arranged boarding for Pitezel's three kids in early October of 1894. He poisoned Benjamin's son in Indianapolis on October 8th. He wrote that he had long knives sharpened at a repair shop, then cut the boy's body into pieces and cremated him in a stove. Holmes claimed he committed the crime for his own pleasure. I'm reading this very deliberately because it's hard to even read it. Authorities found Howard's teeth and pieces of bone among charred runes, according to biography.com. Later in October, Holmes made Benjamin's daughters, Alice and Nettie, get into a large trunk in Toronto. He wrote that he, quote, returned to the house where the children were imprisoned and ended their lives by connecting the gas with the trunk. Then came the opening of the trunk and the viewing of their little blackened and distorted faces.
The so
children,
horrible.
I mean, first off, the word that gets me in that is little.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like blackened and distorted faces is horrible, but the fact that right. he recognizes that they're young kids, like, and this is totally. No way to go, whether or not you're 85 or 8 and a half, it's just
no, but of course kids, like, ugh.
Fucking gruesome. And the children were buried in the basement. Holmes had spent so much time with the children that he was like a second father to them. And certainly with kids, you know, if your parent, this is why parents killing children is like beyond yeah. me, because those are the people that kids blindly trust.
Yeah, you know, totally.
If Holmes is saying, get in the basement, kids, we're going to play a game. Like, of course they're going to get into the basement. You know,
yeah.
like that's what happens.
That's how it goes. Yeah.
Holmes planned to murder Benjamin's wife and his remaining children, but he was arrested in Boston. Thankfully, his trial became a national sensation. Holmes was found guilty of the murder of Benjamin Pitezel and sentenced to death. He wasn't charged with any of the other murders, however. And 2 weeks before Holmes's execution, the Philadelphia Inquirer published his full confessions, paying him between $5,000 and $7,000.
That's
you know,
crazy.
Which obviously, you know, this was before Son of Sam, when Son of Sam was trying to sell the right. rights to his own story. And, you know, so it doesn't encourage people to kind of get book deals from their own murderers.
Yeah.
But, you know, back then, this was not a precedent at all. And the money that he earned from this is said to have gone to his 18-year-old son. Holmes had three children by the time he died. The historical nonfiction book, The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson, is based on Holmes's life. We highly recommend you read it. It's also being made into a movie for Hulu, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and directed by Martin Scorsese. So you
oh.
know that's going to be good. Actually, DiCaprio bought the film rights to the book after reading it.
Well, good for Leonardo DiCaprio for knowing a good, terrible story when he hears it.
Yeah. You know what's surprising, though? Was it surprising to you, John or Megan, that, like, he didn't kill his own children?
I guess so. I mean, it does sort of make you wonder, like, what were the motives? Yeah, like, what
right.
were the standards to why and how he was murdering these people? I mean, you know, it's surprising and shocking, and we move on to the next murder as we do the show, but it's like, you know, there's so many nuances and complications in everyday life, especially back then. Megan, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I almost feel like maybe that was an emotional or a sentimental thing, although nothing that he has done up until this point. Like, because you want to say, oh, well, he didn't murder his children because it would have been too obvious. They're too close to him. Meanwhile, though, he's murdering people who are close to him, like left and right.
Yeah.
Right.
So there doesn't seem to be any reason other than like he didn't want to.
Yeah, I know. That's kind of where my head went.
He could have been so, for me, it's like he seems so, and granted, this is all pure speculation because I'll never meet him or know, but he seems to clearly, if you're murdering someone, there's clearly some mental illness going on.
For sure.
And it could be this like borderline narcissism, right? Where part of it is like he feels like he can get away with it. And then the other part of it is like he's so obsessed with himself that he wants his future generations to be like him. And so he's not going to kill his children because he sort of wants them to live on this amazing, fabulous legacy that he thinks that he created in some odd way. I don't know.
Ew, yeah.
But that could be involved in his psyche. That's kind of where I was going with it. But
yeah, could
we'll
be.
Never know.
Yeah, we'll never really know. Well, there is a theory that H.H. Holmes and Jack the Ripper are the same person. H.H. Holmes's great-great-great-grandson, Jeff Mudgett, wrote a book about it and helped with a history series, American Ripper, which can be streamed on Hulu as well. Mudgett claims he inherited Holmes's diaries and that Holmes wrote about murdering sex workers in London, according to biography.com. That's kind of fascinating if you think about it. Jack the Ripper was active in the White Capel District between 1888 and 1891. I am not from the White Capel District, so I hope I'm saying that right. Just want to throw
that
out there.
I think that might be Whitechapel.
That's a good one, Megan. Chapel.
This is why we have Megan here.
Yeah, let me read.
Megan is Jack the Ripper. Megan.
It's me. And H.H. Holmes.
Let me just... Exactly. Edit note there. Oh, okay. Now, Jack the Ripper was active in the Whitechapel district between 1888 and 1891, but he was never caught, as we all know. Some people think it's unlikely that Holmes and Ripper were the same person, partly because Holmes killed in a methodical, private way, and the Ripper killed women out on the street and mutilated them, which is
right.
true.
And we often see certain patterns of killers, you know, sort of their staple, their hallmark. They want to be known for it. And I do think that Holmes is smart enough to at least kind of change up his killings every time.
Good point.
He's so secretive that I can't see him going from, you know, creating an entire hotel of gas chambers and hidden rooms and staircases to then just brutally murdering someone on the street. Like, it almost seems like he would be, it doesn't seem like they'd be the same person, because he would be like killing his own method to his madness in a way.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, but there was a theory at the time that the Ripper had medical training or a knowledge of anatomy and surgery, because he was removing organs from at least three of his victims, which, you know, is the theory and the story of Jack the Ripper, really. Mudgett claims H.H. Holmes was working with a partner to kill the women. Holmes was allegedly harvesting organs and ovaries in particular, to create a, quote, youth serum that would allow him to live an unnaturally long time, according to WhitechapelJack.com. So
what the fuck is he going to do with those ovaries? What the fuck is he going to do with them?
The theory is that the London murders of sex workers were an attempt to distract from what he was doing back in Chicago, where he was really after the organs of wealthy women because he thought they had healthier hormones in them. Like, where does he come up with this stuff?
Science,
I'm like, what is going on?
Science.
Well, in the American Ripper series, a linguistic expert analyzes a letter that was thought to have been sent by Jack the Ripper to the media. The expert concludes that the letter was most likely written by an American and not an English person. And a composite sketch created by interviewing 13 people who saw women with a man shortly before turning up dead looked similar to Holmes. Holmes was hanged on May 7th, 1896, in Philadelphia's Moya Mensing Prison. His only request was that his grave be buried 10 feet deep and that his coffin be encased in cement. He didn't want anyone digging up his body and dissecting. Remember, he had spent a lot of time doing this very thing to these terrible, you know, murders to these victims. And he had the, Darren, to your point earlier, you know, he's kind of always thinking one step ahead, even in his own death, you know? So that's kind of
disturbing. But like, what would he think we were going to find? Like, well, I think he's just so, I want to be perfect and end my death and no one can get me. And
or maybe
I don't know.
Maybe he recognized the humiliation of it when he was doing it. So he didn't want that same humiliation, you know, from anybody, whoever it may be, for whatever reason, in, you know, his death. But so while he was hanged, his neck unfortunately didn't snap when he was hanged. And, you know, as often is the case, by the way, with these brutal killings and, you know, executions, instead, he suffocated more slowly and his body twitched for 15 minutes while hanging, which, that's just, it's too much.
I have a huge problem with this, and Megan, I don't know if you have anything to add, but I have a huge problem with it, because, like, although, like, H.H. Holmes was clearly a murderer and clearly this horrible person.
Yeah, no,
this is why I don't believe in the death penalty. Like, watching his body twitch for 15 minutes while hanging, and that be, like, and I know, like, if there's a candidate for the death penalty, it's probably
it's
this
him,
guy, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's gotta be him. I'm not saying save his life, but, like, there's something so sick about
it's torturous, really.
This
I just
can't wrap my fucking head around it.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah, Megan, tell us, because you've read, you know, we just talked about Mudgett, who's the great, great, great grandson. Have you read? Didn't you read the book or something?
I did. Yeah, he wrote a book called Bloodstains about his whole conspiracy that H.H. Holmes and Jack the Ripper are the same person, and it's just so bad. It's so
in what
bad
way? It's like, you know, are you saying that the evidence doesn't kind of mount up for what his position?
The evidence that he presents is, like, it's ridiculous. His whole, his main evidence is handwriting analysis.
Oh,
where
okay.
He compares, like, Jack the Ripper's handwriting to Jack the Ripper's other handwriting, because he wrote a lot of things and we know that they were all written by the same person who we call Jack the Ripper. And he couldn't get a handwriting analyst to say
so he
that
just does
Agent
it himself?
Holmes is, he uses a computer program.
Oh dear!
But it's inadmissible to present as evidence this way.
Right,
like,
of
we
course.
Don't use computer programs for handwriting analysis because it's very, very highly
yeah.
skilled sort of thing. And all he has is this computer program. And I don't know if you guys have seen the sketches that he also presents where he's like, oh, yes, 13 people. They made this composite. It looks like every guy on the street, right? If you were to just type in like man from the late 1800s in a bowler
yeah.
hat, it looks like yeah. every single person who comes up in this Google search. It's
so everyone's
so...
like, yeah, it's him. That's definitely him. And it's also every right. other man. Yeah.
And he presents this evidence. He does TED Talks. This is his job. He like tours
oh,
the
dear.
Country and gives these
oh,
presentations
God.
To people where he presents like grand jury style evidence mm. to the viewers in the audience. And he presents it all in such a way where you either have to be like, oh, okay, sure, those things could be true, I guess. Or you
yeah.
have to go through and, like, prove all of these negatives.
Right,
yeah.
it's like too much conjecture on his point. And
right.
also, handwriting is also can change on mood.
Sure.
You know?
Oh, I didn't
so
even
like,
know that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like,
I mean,
makes
sense,
listen,
yeah.
Sometimes if I'm scribbling really quickly, like sometimes my handwriting will go in an upward direction or a downward direction. I mean, the thing is that for people like us, we're not handwriting a lot of stuff anymore in the same way.
Yeah,
you know?
That's
I mean,
true.
Like, I'll take notes, but it's not, it's rare to be writing a handwritten letter. I know people still do this, but just handwriting analysis in general feels
yeah.
very loose. You know, it's like the teeth. It's like the oh, like comparison of a bite mark and teeth as
yeah.
if that's proof in court of evidence. It's like, it's just, it might be fun to think about, but it's not going to hold up in the court of law.
Right. That makes sense. Well, Megan, thank you for that insight. It's good to know that it's from a firsthand account that it might not
do
be.
Do you recommend reading the book?
It's a fun book. It's a quick read.
Okay.
It's not dry. He's pretty fast about it. It's self-published. It's a fun sort of conspiracy theory if you're into that sort of thing. I very much am. But
listen, if anything, it just gives another perspective. It doesn't mean you have to believe it. So
sure,
that's worth,
yeah.
worth reading if nothing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, as we round out this horrifying cases, serial killer, whatever you want to call it, a caretaker of the castle during Holmes's killing spree was also questioned by police about his possible involvement in any of the crimes, but was never charged due to lack of solid evidence. He killed himself in 1914 by drinking strychnine. His suicide note said, quote, "I couldn't sleep," end quote, which is in and of itself very disturbing.
I wonder if to some extent he knew about everything that was happening.
I have a feeling I would.
Got.
Yeah.
Total conjecture, but like, I wonder if he knew. Couldn't, but was getting paid, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
there, you know, maybe Holmes was paying him pretty handsomely. And then the guilt just
took
him over. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, he killed himself in 1914. So that's a solid, what, like 15, 16 years
yeah.
after Holmes had passed away, maybe 20 years or so. So I don't know, man. I mean, that's the thing too, is like guilt is its own weapon in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you're totally right. Well, H.H. Holmes's great-great-great-grandson also said that he wrote about tricking someone to go to the gallows in his place and that he really escaped. So there's that to think about as well. I think it kind of
I wonder how you trick someone to go to, you know, get hanged. I wonder
it's
how you
very,
do that.
It's very bizarre. Like, this guy, these murders and his tactics and his methods are pretty much... You know, they're very unlike anything I've ever heard of. I mean, we've done hundreds and hundreds of murder cases over the years, Darren. And, you know, this one is going to stick out to me for a lot of different reasons moving forward. I don't know about you.
Well, yeah, and there's probably so many people... due to the nature of the fact that he killed a lot of sex workers, you know, who were really
yeah.
the underrepresented victims in a lot of crimes, especially back in the 1800s, and just
yeah.
for it being a sign of the times, there's probably so many victims that we'll just never know. I mean,
yeah,
he's said to have killed between 9 and 200 people. I mean, that's a pretty big window. And fortunately, we're probably just never going to be able to solve it completely. We know that he's a murderer. We just could. We probably can't pinpoint H.H. Holmes's exact killings to everyone. And that's it's kind of the closure we're going to have to deal with, but it's definitely hard.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Well, let us know what you think about this two-part H.H. Holmes series, if you will, here on Shaken and Disturbed. You can find us at Carby Darren and Jay Thrasher. Megan, where can people find you if they wanted to chat with you about your book reading?
Oh, I'm on Instagram. I'm at foffmeg, E-F-F-O-F-F-M-E-G.
Of course you are. Thank you, Megan, for that. Darren, let's move on to some listener shout-outs here, and I'll start the first one, if you don't mind.
Do it up. Yes.
Kylie on Patreon said, Megan is someone I would love to be friends with in real life. Aw, that's so sweet.
Kylie, you think that, and then she invites you to her dungeon in her hotel.
Taxidermy.
And then she's like, hey, do you want to go to this hanging for me? Like, Kylie, I'm just saying, this is so Megan. You know, Megan is so H.H. Holmes, it's ridiculous. I can't even... Can't even explain it. And well, James on Patreon said, I'm listening a few days late, and it is really great to open Patreon and find that Jacob and Marty are already here and dressed so fancy. So,
there
Megan.
There you go.
There you go.
Aww.
You know what? We talked about it. You guys asked for it. There it is. And thanks to Megan for lending us that photo for our Patreon.
There you are.
Yeah. Jacob and Marty may need their own segment on here. Like, they may have to come on and give their two cents about what they're thinking.
Yeah. Like, are they our, like, resident, like, experts? Like, maybe we throw to Jacob and Marty from time to time to give us, their thoughts, something like
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Megan's like,
Absolutely.
That's funny. Well, Candace in our Facebook group said, quote, my connection to Sunday's episode is that I share a birthday with H.H. Holmes. Anyone else's birthday, May 16th? Darren, you're close, but not...
You're
no
eight
cigar.
Days before me, but no. I'm curious of who shares birthdays with serial killers, though. I always think that that's very fun, question mark, or at least interesting. Let us know if you have some iconic
Let's go with interesting.
Murderers to share. Yeah, interesting with a high-pitched voice. But let us know. And, Candace, be sure to remind us that H.H. Holmes' birthday is on May 16th so we can shout you out. And for all of you guys out there, please rate, review, and subscribe to Shake It and Disturb wherever you listen to podcasts. We would greatly appreciate it. And, of course, join us on Patreon for all kinds of fun bonus content, Two-Headed Mice, Jacob and Marty's, opinion of the week. Which obviously is, you got to hear them. They're on the button and on the pulse of what people are thinking.
Of true crime, just absolutely.
Of true crime and pop culture, really. They're on the front lines of this thing. And you can subscribe at patreon.com/shakenanddisturbed or click the link in our show notes.
That's right. Well, thank you for joining us again, Megan. We'll be talking to you again soon in the coming weeks. I think you'll join us for an episode in April or something like that.
Awesome. Can't wait.
And of course, check out Megan's podcast, Rocky Talkie, where she talks about the Rocky Horror Picture Show wherever you listen to podcasts. Megan, how often are you guys releasing episodes?
We're every week.
Okay.
Yeah, we're every week on Thursdays. Our shows drop, so... Yeah,
perfect.
Today.
Do Jacob and Marty have their own segment on the show?
Yeah, like what?
Are they involved or?
Do they have a fee?
They're mascots. They often hang around in the recording room. And
they're going to be in high demand across all these podcasts.
They're going to be invited to every party, every photo op. I mean, Jacob and Marty, Jesus.
We're going
to
make them stars.
They're already dressed for it.
They're very dressed. They're very dressed to impress. Well, thank you guys so much for listening.
Yes.
Have a fantastic week, and we'll see you next Sunday.
Bye.
Bye.